Okay, we're back to 2 Samuel. Let's pray. Our Father, we are again thankful for the ability that you gave us to even be here tonight, and thank you that we have this book in front of us, that it is printed here in millions of copies, and that we can all have a copy, even many copies, and we can read it every day. Father, thank you that we can know this word that can set us free and make us everything that you want us to be. I pray that it would be found that way among us tonight. Amen. Now we are in the midst of a serious trouble here in chapter 13 of 2 Samuel. And it looks like this story is more or less going to run now through about the 20th chapter as we follow the disaster that Absalom created in Israel. And again, we have to remember all the way through the next many chapters that David didn't do a good job in teaching his children because he didn't get them in trouble for anything. He gave them whatever they wanted. And they grew up to be selfish, spoiled brats that would take their sister if they wanted their sister, or the kingdom when they wanted the kingdom. And we have three of David's sons, Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah, all of whom die in the next few chapters of the scriptures. They all die because they didn't know how to say no to themselves for something that they wanted. And they all die in their sin because David did not properly teach them how to say no to. The honest fact of the matter is we say no to almost everything that exists. We only say yes to the things that are both the will of God in general and specifically something that God has done or given to us specifically. And that consists of a teeny tiny little portion of all things that exist. And everything else in the world doesn't belong to us. So you need to have that personal character that you understand what is yours and what is not yours. And the things that are not yours, you may have a parent that requires you not to touch them, or you may be older and you may have the police that requires you not to touch them, but it will be in your very best interest if you can guide yourself not to touch the things that do not pertain to you. And of course, the standard that we're going to go by, that we're going to live by, to understand what things we are supposed to have and what things we are not supposed to have, is going to be found here in the Word of God. And so this is going to be the lifetime book of study for everyone who is going to follow God, because this book will keep us from every evil way. I want to start in the 13th chapter, which we read this morning, and I want to read starting with verse 22 all the way through the end of the 14th chapter. And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. And it came to pass after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shears in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, behold, now thy servant hath sheep shears. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant. And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Then said Absalom, "If not, I pray thee, let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" But Absalom pressed him, that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not, have not I commanded you? Be courageous and be valiant." And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up upon his mule and fled. And it came to pass while they were in the way that tidings came to David, saying, "Absalom has slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left." Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by him with their clothes rent. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead." But Absalom fled, and the young men that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, "Behold, the king's sons come. As thy servant said, so it is." And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. The king also and all his servants wept very sore. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Amihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the soul of David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. Now Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was toward Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and fetched thence a wise woman, and said unto her, "I pray thee, feign thyself to be a mourner, and put on now mourning apparel, and anoint thyself with oil, but be as a woman that had a long time mourned for the dead, and come to the king and speak on this manner unto him." So Joab put the words in her mouth. And when the woman of Tekoa spake to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and did obeisance and said, "Help, O king." And the king said unto her, "What aileth thee?" And she answered, "I am indeed a widow woman, and mine husband is dead. And thy handmaid had two sons, and they two strove together in the field, and there was none to part them, but the one smote the other and slew him. And behold, the whole family is risen against thine handmaid. And they said, 'Deliver him that smote his brother, that we may kill him for the life of his brother whom he slew, and we will destroy the heir also. And so they shall quench my coal which is left, and shall not leave to my husband neither name nor remainder upon the earth.' And the king said unto the woman, 'Go to thine house, and I will give charge concerning thee.' And the woman of Tekoa said unto the king, 'My lord, O king, the iniquity be on me and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless.' And the king said, 'Whosoever saith aught unto thee, bring him to me, and he shall not touch thee any more.' Then she said, 'I pray thee, let the king remember the Lord thy God, that thou wouldst not suffer the revengers of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son.' And he said, 'As the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth.' Then the woman said, 'Let thine handmaid, I pray thee, speak one word unto my lord the king.' And he said, 'Say on.' And the woman said, 'Wherefore then hast thou thought such a thought against the people of God? For the king doth speak this thing as one which is faulty, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished. For we must needs die, and are as water spilt on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God respect any person, yet doth he devise means that his banished be not expelled from him. Now therefore, that I am come to speak of this thing unto my lord the king, it is because the people have made me afraid, and thine handmaid said, I will now speak unto the king, that it may be that the king will perform the request of his handmaid. For the king will hear to deliver his handmaid out of the hand of the men that would destroy me and my son together out of the inheritance of God.' Then thine handmaid said, The word of my lord the king shall now be comfortable. For as an angel of God, so is my lord the king to discern good and bad. Therefore the Lord thy God will be with thee. Then the king answered and said unto the woman, Hide not from me, I pray thee, the thing that I shall ask thee. And the woman said, Let my lord the king now speak. And the king said, Is not the hand of Joab with thee in all this? And the woman answered and said, As thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right hand or to the left from aught that my lord the king has spoken. For thy servant Joab, he bade me, and he put all these words in the mouth of thine handmaid. To fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing, and my lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth. And the king said unto Joab, Behold, now I have done this thing. Go, therefore, bring the young man Absalom again. And Joab fell to the ground on his face and bowed himself and thanked the king. And Joab said, Today thy servant knoweth that I have found grace in thy sight, my lord, O king, in that the king hath fulfilled the request of his servant. So Joab arose and went to Geshur and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, Let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house and saw not the king's face. But in all Israel there was none to be so much praised as Absalom for his beauty. From the sole of his foot even to the crown of his head there was no blemish in him. And when he polled his head, for it was at every year's end that he polled it, because the hair was heavy on him, therefore he polled it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels after the king's weight. And unto Absalom there were born 3 sons and 1 daughter, whose name was Tamar. She was a woman of a fair countenance. So Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face. Therefore Absalom sent for Joab to have sent him to the king, but he would not come to him. And when he sent again the second time, he would not come. Therefore he said unto his servants, See, Joab's field is near mine, and he hath barley there. Go and set it on fire. And Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and came to Absalom unto his house and said unto him, Wherefore have thy servants set my field on fire? And Absalom answered Joab, Behold, I sent unto thee, saying, Come hither, that I may send thee to the king, to say, Wherefore am I come from Geshur? It had been good for me to have been there still. Now therefore let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. So Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. There is so much in these next numbers of chapters about Absalom that is so appalling that we don't even know exactly what to do with all of it. But there are we're gonna go through this as best we can over these next few chapters of disaster, and we're going to try to make some sense at least out of it. And there are potentially a multitude of different things that we may glean from these chapters that we may not know how to put it all together. But one thing that I want to start out by saying, this is something that I have never spent much time in my life studying types. But I did hear my dad say many times that David is a type of Christ in the day of grace, where the righteousness of the reign of Jesus Christ is not being established yet in the earth. But Jesus now is reigning, sitting on the Father's throne in heaven. And he has been anointed king, but he is in a day of grace right now. And so it is said that the life of David pictures the reign of grace. And when Solomon comes to sit on the throne, it pictures when Jesus returns to earth and sets up his kingdom. And of course we will come to that transition when David gives command to Solomon to sit on the throne. And David tells Solomon at that time to carry out justice on many people that David did not ever carry out justice in his life. Whether or not all of this is truly built into this system, you know, I have not ever studied it. But it is true that the way that David ran his kingdom was more like a New Testament dispensation rather than an upholding of the strictness of the law. Now, I am not prepared to stand up here tonight and tell you whether I think David was right in all of his choices or if he was wrong. I have a very strong feeling, personal feeling, that David made some of these choices rightly in that he ran his kingdom as a more of a New Testament kingdom rather than under the law. And I think that David very clearly understands, because of the Psalms that you read that he wrote, he very clearly understands the forgiveness of sins, which was not a doctrine of the law, except as typified in the sacrifices. And he writes, and David's words are the prophecies of the coming Christ. David himself has just experienced complete disobedience to the law in his own life, and he was frankly forgiven for free by God. So, what do you do if you are David and you have sinned, you've sinned a horrible sin in taking another man's wife, then killing the man and so on, and God frankly forgives you on the spot for it, and then your sons act like yourself? What do you do? Is it even right? Would it have even been morally right at that moment for David to have stood up and executed judgment on his sons? I'm only asking questions tonight because I honestly don't even fully know the answers to these questions myself. But I can tell you one thing. If there's any one thing that we want to get out of the life of David and the story of his sons, the one thing that we want to get is, don't ever get yourself into a place that you have to make a choice on things like that. It is time when you are at the beginning of things to follow God's word, instead of when you are at the end of things and you've got a disaster on your hand and there is no right way to handle it anymore. And there is truly such a thing in life where situations of life become so complicated there isn't a right choice. And at that point, sometimes you just have to blunder on through the things that are forced on you because you have no other place to go. And so as we have these stories, Absalom here kills, he murders, he disobeys the law, he murders his brother with no biblical right or authority to do it. He murders him, he hates him. Hatred and murder, we know, are connected as the basic same thing. If you kill a person accidentally, when you didn't have hatred in your heart for him, that is not considered murder in the Old Testament law. Unfortunately, our country today does consider it murder. I think our country is wrong on that point. But either way, under the law, it was not considered murder, but hatred is very connected with murder. Absalom hated Amnon, and that's why he killed him, and he had no business killing him. According to the law, Absalom had to die because Absalom killed his brother. That's all there is to it. It doesn't matter if his brother was a sinner or not. Absalom did not carry out any lawful killing of his brother. It was unlawful, and because Absalom hated and killed his brother, Absalom was condemned to death. Now, then Absalom flees. Of course, he knows he's condemned. He knows he has done wrong. He flees and he goes and lives in another country for 3 years. But in his own heart, he was righteous. What should the king do in this situation? Is it the king's responsibility to go kill his son? How can you kill your son for for killing another man when you just were responsible for the death of another man and you got forgiven for it. But let me tell you something. When Jesus offers grace to the whole wide world, it comes in two different forms. To the Christian, it comes as an incentive to righteousness. And to the ungodly, it comes as an incentive to sin. When David got given the grace of God, it made him righteous. But when Absalom got given the grace of David, it made him unrighteous. And of course, we see a very determined progression here, where first Absalom kills his brother. He flees. Now, Absalom apparently must have been somewhat close to Joab. Joab liked him and wanted him home. David also, of course, loved his son and wanted him home. But everybody was ignoring the situation until what we read in the 14th chapter, where Absalom brings this woman to come and complain to the king about a situation that is exactly identical. She's in a rough situation. She's lost her husband. And now she has two sons, and one of her sons kills his brother. And of course, this story is all fake. But we're making up a story that is similar to David's situation. And so she's telling this story, and David can sympathize with her because David understands what it means to just simply need the forgiveness of God. So David is sympathetic to her story because here she is a widow. She's got one son left. She needs her son to take care of her. She wants her son to carry on the family name and to inherit the family property. And she's in a horrible situation here. She has no option. And the only thing that the law has for her is condemnation. And so she's hoping that she's going to, in this story, get forgiveness for her son who killed his brother. It takes a little bit of reasoning and her different statements that she makes to David for David to finally fully come out and say, "As the Lord liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth." And then the woman says, "Wherefore then hast thou thought such a thing against the people of God? For the king doth speak this thing as one which is faulty, in that the king doth not fetch home again his banished." If it is indeed true that this woman's son in this story that she makes up should be forgiven, and he should not be killed because of the situation, and if forgiveness can be offered to this man, then why is it that this Absalom guy is still hiding out in another country? Why isn't he brought home and forgiven? Now, of course, there's ulterior motives here in Joab for requesting this, because obviously Joab wants him back. He has something to gain. But as the story unfolds, as we go through it, David listens. And he says to Joab, we just read it, and I'm not going to go through this chapter very much in depth. The story is pretty clear as we read it. David says to Joab, "You can go bring Absalom back." And so Joab does. But when Absalom returns to Jerusalem, David obviously has such a mix of emotions that he doesn't even know what to do in the situation. He brings him home, but he refuses to see him. He tells him to go to his own house. So Absalom now has returned to Jerusalem, and he dwells there for 2 years and never sees his dad. And so he sends to Joab for help. I mean, Joab was the one responsible for bringing him back. Now let's see if Joab can get him further help. So he sends to Joab for help. But Joab doesn't know what to do because of the stand that David has taken on him. Joab is confused, and Joab is David's right-hand man and head of the army and has to stay on David's good side, and so he's not going to see Absalom either. And so Absalom says, "Well, hey, there's more than one way to get attention." Joab has a field of barley growing that's ready to harvest. Let's light this on fire. He'll come and see me then. And so he does. And when David brings, when Joab goes to see Absalom, Absalom makes his complaint. Wherefore am I come from Geshur? It had been good for me to have been there still. Now therefore let me see the king's face, and if there be any iniquity in me, let him kill me. Now the fact of the matter is, there wasn't actually any good in him. He was a sinner by birth, and he was a very horribly wicked sinner by choice. There was nothing good to be found in this man. He had killed his brother out of hatred. He had lit somebody's field on fire just to get attention. And he was proud enough about the he was proud enough of himself and unrepentant enough of his sins that not only had he done these things, but he didn't believe he had done wrong. And he was willing to go and sit in front of his father's face and say, if there's any iniquity in me, let him kill me. He didn't think he was guilty of anything. This is the normal way that you find the people of the world. They don't have sin. Or if they do have, it's one here or one there in the past somewhere. They're not guilty of anything. They are doing right. And it is the first step for salvation. The very first step for salvation is coming to the place where you acknowledge yourself to be a sinner. Jesus didn't come to save the righteous. He came to save sinners. If you're not a sinner, you don't need Jesus. Absalom had no sin. He wanted to go see the king, and Absalom was not looking for forgiveness for his sins. He was looking for his dad to tell him that he was okay the way he was. Now, what should David have done in this situation? Don't judge David. Ask yourself what you would have done if you have to face that situation in the next year or 20 years, depending on how old your son is. What would you do? I don't think David did right. I don't think whether or not David was acting properly in living by principles of grace in the kingdom that he was running or not. He was still absolutely neglecting his duty to his son Absalom in making him face the wrongs that he had done. David did not just frankly get forgiven by God when he was holding on to his sin. He got forgiven when he repented of his sin and when he said he had sinned against God. He got forgiven when Nathan the prophet came to him and confronted him about his sin. Absalom here is getting by scot-free. Nobody's telling him that he did anything wrong. He is not making right on anything. He's not saying sorry to anybody. He is maintaining his innocence. And he comes and he bows himself before the king and the king kissed him. Now, it is no surprise at all that when we are dealing with a situation like this, we are going to come to the next chapter, chapter 15, and Absalom is going to raise himself up to be the king. He is not going to be promoted there by his fellow men. He is not going to be given the position by somebody who's head of the army. He is going to take himself and promote himself to be the king. Now, supposing that we are Absalom right now. We've murdered our brother. We've stayed in hiding for 3 years. We have lit people's fields on fire. We have lived an evil life where we have never said no to ourselves about anything that we wanted. We have done what we wanted to please ourselves, and we have this belief about ourselves that we are the most important person in all of Israel to the point that the kingdom belongs to us. It's pretty obnoxious. Some say that Absalom was in line as the eldest of David's sons. And because Amnon was older than him and he killed Amnon, he actually did that to secure the kingdom for himself because he would inherit it supposedly by right. Well, and God had never said such a thing. God had never said that the eldest person would inherit the kingdom. It did play out for most of the years of Israel's history that they did that. But I do not believe that was of God. I do not believe he ordained it that way or he ever said such a thing would happen. But anyway, Absalom was one of David's eldest sons, if he was not the oldest at this point. So he may have justified himself on believing that the kingdom belonged to him in that he was going to inherit it. But the only problem with that was David was still alive and still the king. And if you want to compare that against how David treated the situation when Saul was the king, and Saul not only was Saul was rejected of God. God had already anointed David to be the king. And yet David would not do anything against Saul all the while he remained king. Quite a difference as we come to David's son, and David takes the kingdom for himself in spite of the fact that his father is still reigning as the king. How is it possible in a situation like this that we can look at a man who was so godly as David was, so walked with God, wrote many portions of the scriptures, and has a son that turns out so abominably wicked, absolutely abominably wicked? I can tell you one thing. Never one time in all of David's life did he ever, while Absalom was growing up, tell Absalom that he had the right to do wrong. The only thing that David failed in this whole situation was he spoiled the kid. He let him have everything that he wanted. If Absalom asked for something, he got it. And by the time he got to be an adult, it really didn't matter anymore what the issue was, what it was that he wanted. If he wanted something, he got it. And he was going to take it if somebody didn't give it to him. I was appalled to listen to somebody that grew up in this church say those basic words some years ago. I don't even understand how you can possibly think the thought. But one person who grew up in this church, when all of us who are now adults were growing up here, basically said those words about his children. I don't think that my kids should have any rules. I think they should be allowed to make their own choices and do what they want. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your name is. I don't care who your kids are. I don't care how godly you are. If that is your principle for raising kids, it's not going to turn out. Your kids will never make the right choices if they are allowed to choose for themselves. They come out sinners, and they come out with the inability to even understand the difference between right and wrong and make the wrong choices automatically. And if somebody is not there to guide those first 30 years, the first 30 years, listen carefully now, they will make the wrong choices starting at about 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, depending on the child, they will make the wrong choices. thankfully, the person who said this about their children, they shouldn't have any rules, they should be able to make all their decisions for themselves, is not following that rule to a T in their lives. They're following it way too much, but not totally, because I think the kids would have already been awful if they had. So they just follow it partially. But the theory, they believe the theory. It's a wrong theory. It's a false theory. It can't work. You can't take a sinner and let them make their own choices. If somebody's going to do right when they are a sinner by nature on the inside, they're going to need a book from God to guide their choices, because they aren't going to be able to do it themselves. Absalom had, how many of you guys, if you just had the opportunity to all of a sudden be 3,000 years old, 4,000, whatever it would be, and go back and sit with David for a day, how many of you guys would like to just go sit with David for a day and talk to him about all the things that he experienced and all the things that happened in his life and the knowledge of God that he gained? And wouldn't you just like to just have one bit of information, one time, pick any one psalm he wrote and ask him how he wrote it? When and how did these thoughts come to you? What were you doing? What happened when you picked up your pen and you wrote this down? What happened to you? Wouldn't you just like to have some stories? He with Abraham are probably the two most held up people in all of the Old Testament, David and Abraham. And the only thing that he had to do was just let his kids make their own choices to get sons like he got. And his three oldest sons, Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah, all die for their sins. Now, Absalom had apparently been one of those people that we were speaking of this morning already, who was everybody's friend. The kind of a person who did for anybody anything they wanted, always was the uplifter, the person who was whatever you want to call it. Because he's very well liked by all the people of the country. Joab wants him back. This woman says, according to Joab, she says, let's see here. Well, I'm not going to find the verse now, but it's right in this chapter we just read, where she basically says, all the people of Israel are like water poured out on the earth. If Absalom doesn't come home, the nation's destroyed. We have to have Absalom here. He's that important to the people, at least according to Joab. But as we go through the 15th chapter next, we will see his divisiveness and the way that he pretends to be the person who is interested in everybody's cause. Now, he lies to the people. I don't want to get too deep into this, because we'll go over this next time. But it says that every person that comes to him, he says to them, "See, your matters are good and right." Well, that is not possible, because in every case, when there is a disagreement between two people, and when there are two people fighting, there's one person that is right and one person that is wrong. or two people that are wrong. And so how could it be that you could always be on everybody's side who comes to you, except that you were just exactly like your father, the devil, who is always... Satan has many tactics, but his major, most major tactic is that you are the person who he is serving. Satan is your friend. He's the one, he's your giver. He's your life sustainer. He's your helper. He's the one who says you can have the things that God says you can't have. Satan is always there for you. Now, as a matter of fact, he isn't always that way for everybody in life, because once he gets a person hooked into a chain that they can't get out of, very, very often Satan becomes the exact opposite of that, where he is your biggest enemy and your biggest persecutor in life. But that's not his major way of starting with people. The way he traps people in sin is being their best friend. He comes as the friend, the subtle person who says just exactly what you want to hear. So Absalom, did Absalom have to pay for Joab's field? You go back to the law. I didn't write this verse down, but if you go back to the law, God said that if anybody kindled a fire and it spread and it went into anybody's standing corn or into anybody else's property, that whoever kindled the fire would be responsible for all the damages that it caused. Did Absalom have to pay for Joab's field of barley? Well, let's suppose that he got everything that he wanted. Let's just sit here and make a guess as to whether or not he wanted to pay for Joab's field of barley. I'm going to say no, he didn't want to. So I'm going to say he didn't have to. It is never, ever good to get a person into this state. Our nation is going downhill very quickly. But one of the ways that has been the more recent things, more in my lifetime that it has happened, is that we have taken a national stand against discipline. It's not going to work. When it gets to the point, if we take a national stand against discipline and it gets to the point that everybody gets everything they want, who is going to be the person who provides the food for all the people who are in jail when the whole population is in jail because they couldn't keep the law? It doesn't work. We can't all do everything that we want. We all have to keep the law. We all have to make the right choices. And how are you going to get people there without some form of discipline? Discipline is God-ordained, is absolutely necessary. And as we younger folks that have children here, as we go about guiding our kids into the perfect will of God with what we are trying to do, teaching them, teaching and admonishing them in the things of God as we go about that, it is much less important exactly what theories we have as that we have a clear theory of discipline and that we are consistent with it. Your child isn't going to turn out wrong because you let him have something that another family thinks is way too expensive and ridiculous for a child to own. Your child isn't going to turn out wrong because you let him say a word that another person thinks is a terrible, awful word. We have to listen to Roy and Drusilla chat about this once in a while. It bothers Drusilla a little bit. She has to be a very tough woman as they travel around from place to place and always stay with a family. Everywhere they go, she says, they get ragged on by the people of the home for how their children are. And the one family will tell them, why do you let your kids do this? You can't do that, blah, blah, blah. And the next time they go somewhere else, that family tells them the opposite. And everybody thinks their method is perfect. Exactly how I raise my kids is exactly the right way, the only right way. And we want to hold everybody to our own personal standards. Well, the standard that God holds up is you should probably beat them if they don't listen to you, okay? I mean beat them. That's what the Bible says. Now, we don't mean that in the sense of an evil beating, but we mean that in the sense of accomplishing a job. They get a paddling on their butt if they can't listen. They can listen with that. So that's a very biblical rule, paddling on their butt. Another absolute is that we teach them the words of God. We teach them what God said, and we teach them the difference between right and wrong. Those are a couple of absolutes. But the rest of the things, how you do things, whether or not you're going to make them learn this thing in school, or whether or not you're going to require this or that, we can all have our own little differences, and the kids will not be hurt at all. They're already hurt because they were born with us as parents. We gave them our sin nature. They're already hurt there. Now, the other little things, it's great to have a standard in your family. And if you do have a standard, whatever it is, stick with it, keep with it, and do it. But don't hold your neighbor to the same standard that you have. Your neighbor has to also raise their children in the fear of God and make them listen and make them be good and so on. But we don't have to require the same things. You set your children's bedtime at 9 o'clock at night and say, I think all my family's going to bed at 9 o'clock at night. Then you make your kids abide by that. And when the rest of your whole church gets together and has an 11 o'clock party some night, you tell your kids they can't go. But it's not because those other families are doing something wrong. It's just because in this family we're going to bed at 9 o'clock. I like the way I grew up when we had breakfast at 7 or 8 o'clock. We had lunch at noon every day. I mean, if it got to be 12:05 and we hadn't sat down at the table yet, that was a shocking day. And we had supper at 5 o'clock every night. Come to my family and you find out there is no such thing. I mean, supper can be anywhere from 5 o'clock in the afternoon, not normally, but it can be anywhere from there all the way up to 11:30 at night. Bedtime should be by 10 o'clock. But we don't have any rules in the family. And so sometimes bedtime might not be till midnight. Now, getting up in the morning, there is some basic rules for. During school time, out of bed at 7 o'clock. Well, you know what? It's a basic rule. And they don't really do a very good job at it. But what do you do if you got to bed at 11:30 the last night? 7 o'clock is maybe getting a little early. Now, I don't mind if another family has very strict time schedules for how their kids go to bed and get up, but we don't. Did you find it anywhere in the scriptures that you had to? No. Are you better if you have time than me? Maybe. But I'm not going to join you. I'm set in my ways. If you see somebody doing something and you think you've got a way that works better, fine, go do it. But then keep those individual things as your preferences and not as a matter of right and wrong. It will definitely help keep a lot of peace among many people where we don't We don't have to run each other's lives. Rather, we can encourage each other in their lives. But we can all agree on the absolutes. There has to be strict discipline in the home. What is required has to be required, and we aren't going to change it. We're going to make it happen, because that's going to give the kids character. Sometimes we need correction, too, because sometimes we don't necessarily understand. And sometimes we're even trying, and it's not going that good for us. I don't suppose any of you guys have ever experienced that. But I don't care who you are. If you don't have discipline in the family, your kids are going to be like David's kids were. If you let your kids make their own choice, your kids are going to be like David's kids, because they're going to make the wrong choices. So I think we will quit there for tonight.